This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Guy McPherson. More than 10 years into a career in the academic ivory tower, McPherson turned his efforts on social criticism. These efforts continue with climate change a primary focus of his current work. So I guess where I'd like to start is, can you tell me how you first became involved in working on climate change and then how that led to leaving academia, and then after that, tell us what is your current thinking on the global climate catastrophe?
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me on the show, Derek. I appreciate the time with you.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
And you'll probably have to ask those questions again, because I can hardly keep track from one minute to the next what's going on in my head. I started studying climate change as part of my graduate work. So this goes back, 30-some years now. And I was doing plant ecology research, and it became clear that recruitment pulses, recruitment events for some of the species I was working on depended to a great extent on prior rainfall events. And so it started as simply as that, looking at rainfall and how it influenced recruitment of some species. And the next thing you know, I'm going down the rabbit hole of climate change in the past and how rapidly it's changed in the past and how these pulses are critically important. And the next thing you know, I'm studying climate change experimentally and working with people conducting experiments where we actually manipulate things in the field and figure out how the plants and the plant interactions respond to those manipulations. And so suddenly we're manipulating things like relative humidity and precipitation and shade and so on. And it was 2002, I was working on a book, editing a book with a colleague of mine, a grad student at the time, and he's gone to direct the National Phenology Network for the United States now. We were working on a book together, and it was about climate change with a focus on precipitation. Up to that point, people had been concerned primarily about temperature, and nobody really looked at precipitation, even though obviously it's critically important to ecosystems, when and how much it rains. And so in working on that book, it occurred to me that we had likely triggered our own extinction by 2030 or so. And so and obviously I mourned for months to the bemused curiosity of the three people who noticed. And it was horrifying to me that this could even be happening. And at the time, I didn't really understand a lot about climate change. I didn't know that there was this 40-year lag between emissions and temperature rise. There were a whole bunch of things that I didn't understand, but still I was able to see where we were headed. And I thought, I don't really know all that much about it, and I only marginally considered myself a climate scientist at that point. Surely other people must be looking at this. Ultimately, that led to increasingly intensive studies of climate change. And it was about a year or so later, I was working on another book, and I came across the notion of global peak oil, or the maximum extraction rate of crude oil. And it occurred to me that this is potentially the Hail Mary pass, that as oil declines in quantity, surely industrial civilization will be terminated. Well, that was 2003, and then into early 2004. So it's more than 10 years ago now, and it's pretty obvious that we've triggered too many self-reinforcing feedback loops, and the climate has changed so dramatically, and the evidence has accumulated so profoundly in this last decade, that even if industrial civilization ceases today, it's not going to save humans. And it's certainly going to do nothing about the 150 to 200 species we're driving to extinction every day. So there we are. I moved to this homestead, left the university, a major university in the southwestern United States, in 2009, just about 5 years ago. In light of the collapse I was certain was right around the corner, and also in light of climate change. But it turns out it's a huge mistake because it's the wrong place to be in light of climate change evidence that has accumulated in the last 5 years, the wrong place to be for humans in any event. So there we are. I'm pretty sure I've forgotten at least one of the questions you asked, but my voice is warmed up now, so we can roll.
Yeah, there's a few directions I would like to sort of go with that. One of them is that you mentioned 30 years ago, and when this is something that I find obviously frustrating is the complete insanity of the whole global warming debate. And one of the things that I found very frustrating ever since 1981 is that in 1981 or 1982, I was taking a class on solar heating and cooling in the physics department at the Colorado School of Mines. And at that point, the instructor was giving probably a very similar lecture to what would be given today on runaway global warming. My point being that this was, even at a really conservative engineering school, this was absolutely standard. I mean, obviously, once again, there is more, the feedback means are better understood these days, but this was not particularly controversial among the scientific set in 1981, is my point. And yet we still hear today, you know, that, oh, the science isn't, quote, resolved, whatever resolved actually means.
Right. It's,
we can even go further back. I mean, I don't remember the guy's names, but there was the guy in the 19th century who was describing this, and then the guy in the 1930s who was describing it pretty well. I don't know if we really want to go the direction of denial quite yet, or if we want to wait on that, but I guess I just did want to say that you yourself were studying this 30 years ago, is my point.
Yes, and it's not as if I was the first person to show up to the party. You're right, we've had these warnings for a long time. George Perkins Marsh, U.S. ambassador and naturalist, a pretty amazing combination that you never hear about anymore, U.S. ambassador and naturalist, in September 1847, wrote about the effects of burning fossil fuels on climate change. That's 1847. That's you know, a lot of people mark the beginning of the Industrial Revolution at about 1850, some people at 1750. But in any event, we didn't start burning fossil fuels at scale until 1850, 1860 or so. That's 1847. And then Svante Arrhenius, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, described in April 1896, he expected a 1 degree C temperature increase by the year 2000, and he missed it only slightly. So we have the theory, we have these predictions, and then in February of 1938, Guy Callender described in a journal article that the global temperature of the Earth was actually increasing. So we've had the evidence, we had the theory, the notion since 1896, or even before, if you want to go back to Mars. And then we had the data demonstrating that fossil fuels were driving temperature rise at the global level in 1938. And here we are in 1914, and people are still wondering when it's going to start happening.
So I guess two directions to go. The first direction would be, can you lay out for us? I didn't know this until I wrote this for my book Dreams, that I did an exploration of the previous extinction events and mass extinction events, and it ends up the changing of the climate has driven all of them in one way or another. Can you talk for a moment about why and how relatively rapid climate change, of which this is one of the fastest, leads to mass extinction.
Yes, this is the sixth great extinction. There have been another dozen or so extinction events that are not called great extinctions. I'm not suggesting they're great, by the way, in a positive way. And each of the previous five has been strongly influenced by changes in global average temperature. And there are a couple of reasons for that. It can either get too cold or too hot in a hurry. And by in a hurry, I'm talking about over thousands of years, much too rapidly for most organisms to adapt. So natural selection, leading to evolution, takes many, many generations to play out. So when you have changes that occur over a few thousand years, that's not very many generations for mutations to arise, which, of course, mutations arise inadvertently or accidentally, and then to have those mutations be selected upon and lead to a survivor. So as a consequence, during the Great Dying, 251 million years ago, the planet experienced about 97% loss of the taxa. The more recent event, about 55 million years ago, there was well over 90% loss of taxa. So these are huge extinction level events. The one that's going on right now, the sixth great extinction, is proceeding more rapidly than any other in history, in Earth's history. In fact, according to a paper in Science in August of last year, climate change is on track to occur 10 times faster than at any time during the last 65 million years. And 55 million years ago, or within that span of the last 65 million years, 55 million years ago, according to a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the planet experienced a 5-degree sea rise during a span of 13 years. If we're going 10 times faster than that, there's no way we can keep up as human animals with changes in habitat. And I suspect almost every other species on the planet will join that party as well because of climate change. So far, the extinctions within the last couple hundred years are driven primarily by other artifacts of industrial civilization, not so much by climate change. It's only within the last couple of decades that climate change has risen to the fore as one of the primary drivers of extinction. But we're doing a lot of other things, as you've described really, really well on your work, all of which takes us to extinction of numerous species. So even without invoking the climate disaster.
You know, and that's one of the things that makes me even more worried than I would be other, or terrified, or whatever word we want to use, than I would be otherwise, is that at least, you know, 50 million years ago, or 250 million years ago, at least there were still corridors, or there was still mass habitat where those creatures who can move were capable. They had pathways that at least they could attempt to flee. And at this point, when you combine endocrine disruptors already weakening individuals' bodies and cities, making it so there are no pathways for them to easily move, and fragmented habitat. I mean, we both know about how it's easier to drive a creature extinct on an island than on a continent. And at this point, it really is all sort of island ecology in terms of little patches of generally disconnected habitat. So it's, when you combine all these things, when you combine, for example, the changing of the temperature of the ocean with the fact that there is, 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton, and when you combine the fact that they've been dumping toxins in for, you know, hundreds of years, this is a recipe for multi-system failure.
Yes, and that multi-system failure is well underway. You don't have to look very hard to find an ecosystem, even at a relatively large scale, that is in the midst of being destroyed.
You know, I live in the middle of a small forest that is at, I live in a town of about 4,000 people, and I live sort of at the edge in a what could be called relatively intact forest. With, you know, the fact that I call it relatively intact is based on the fact that we have declining baselines, and I have, you know, it's like there's a stream nearby where I occasionally see salmon, but the thing should be full of salmon. And the point I'm getting at is, you know, I don't use any pesticides here. I don't, you know, I don't do anything but let the trees live. And still, one of the things I find incredibly troubling is even on the level of roly-polies and daddy long legs, the populations of those have collapsed in the last 5 years here. That when I, just purely anecdotally, when I carry wood in for my mom for her wood stove, 5 years ago, I might have to not gently take off maybe a half dozen sow bugs for every piece of wood that I take in. And I think this whole winter, I've probably seen a total of 20 sow bugs. And my point is that even when you have tiny, tiny little creatures like that who don't require large amounts of habitat and who don't migrate, like, I don't know how migratory songbirds are surviving at all, but when you have a small creature with a small habitat in a fairly friendly place, and they too are collapsing, it's like there's a lot of stuff going on that we have no idea. You see what I'm trying to get at with that?
Oh, yes. We can only see small parts of this much bigger picture. And for the most part, the corporate media and the corporate governments of the world are failing to report on even those small parts, much less connecting any three or four dots to drive it into a larger picture. And it's not just the corporate governments, and it's not just corporate media, it's the corporate scientists as well. And here I'm indicting academic scientists, and I used to be one, and I know what drives that system. I know what allows them to go to work every day. I know how they get their money, and it's by playing the corporate game to a very great extent. And so, yes, it's as Utah Phillips said years ago before he died, the earth is not dying, it is being killed. And those who are killing it have names and addresses. And we've known this for a really long time. And the scientists keep going and making these tiny, almost insignificant observations, and then reporting on those observations in language that is unbelievably conservative and fails to point out how dire the situation has become.
I want to come back to that in a second. I think that's a desperately important point. But first I would like to ask you, we've mentioned feedback loops a couple times, and we've mentioned runaway global warming, and I'm wondering if you can just sort of explain to people what that means. How does, give them the primer on what a positive feedback loop is concerning global warming.
Yes. So one example I like to use, an analog, is kicking a soccer ball on a soccer field. And it doesn't take long before the soccer ball comes to a stop because the friction from the grass slows it down so quickly. With positive feedbacks, we're throwing rocks over cliffs. And so at the beginning, they don't go very quickly, but they pick up speed pretty quickly. And the faster they go, the further down they get. And the further down they get, the faster they go. And so it's an accelerating process that's feeding on itself. So let me give an example. The first example that was reported in the Referee Journal literature about climate change, which is methane hydrates or clathrates bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. These hydrates or clathrates are cages that are enclosing methane molecules. And as they warm, the cage is opened up and the methane is released directly into the atmosphere, into the ocean, and then it bubbles up into the planetary atmosphere. So these methane hydrates are bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. That was described in Science in March 2010, so about 4 years ago now. And the more methane that goes into the atmosphere, the warmer it gets. And the warmer it gets, the faster these methane hydrates are warmed and rise up out of the Arctic Ocean and into the atmosphere. So these hydrates are at relatively shallow depths in the ocean, on the sea floor in the Arctic Ocean, 100 and 800 meters, say. And so it doesn't take much warming at that depth to cause them to rise up and bubble up onto the surface. Methane in the short term, meaning less than a couple of decades, is about 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas, molecule for molecule, than carbon dioxide. So it doesn't take a lot of methane to contribute greatly to planetary warming, general planetary warming. And so the more methane we get, the faster the methane comes out. The faster the methane comes out, the warmer it gets. And we've triggered 31 of these so far enforcing feedback loops now. That's just one of them.
And something that highlights the insanity of this culture is that I've seen just bunches and bunches of papers describing how people want to not only allow those hydrates, methyl hydrates, to thaw and escape, but they actually want to mine them and burn them as a source of energy. So they intentionally want to facilitate this process in many ways.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so they want to go down and catch them on the seafloor before they start coming out. Methane, harvest them while they're still in their cages, and then set the cage free and allow us to maintain this set of living arrangements through the use of methane, even though it's killing us. It's truly absurd.
Yeah. And the response to the Arctic melting, which is another positive feedback loop, the response to the Arctic melting has been equally horrifying, in that instead of people being terrified that it's melting, a lot of people in power are responding with what I could only describe as lust for the resources that will be available under the previously frozen areas.
Exactly right. So Arctic drilling was actually fast-tracked by the Obama administration during the summer of 2012, because that's gas and oil up there. And now that we're past the peak in conventional crude oil, we're willing to go to any port in the storm that is industrial civilization as it's going down. And so that means harvesting really expensive, difficult to get to gas and oil. And at the same time, it's now a pretty slushy Arctic during much of the year. So supertankers are taking advantage of that, demonstrating that every catastrophe represents a business opportunity. So the slushy Arctic makes it easy to take the shortcut over the Arctic instead of going the long way around through the Panama Canal. And so we can save a few bucks doing that. And as nearly as I can tell, that's the whole point of this culture. Just save a few bucks and make money as the world burns.
You know, I heard a great line the other day. I read a great line maybe a month ago, and there's a lot of pretty interesting stuff about how plants communicate. And they, if a caterpillar is eating a leaf, then the plant will send out messages to other plants to say, hey, the caterpillars are here. You need to change the composition of your leaves to make them less desirable. And a question that a couple of scientists were asking that just appalled me and made me laugh at the insanity of the culture is, they couldn't figure out why plants would warn competitors of their of an impending danger. Why would they waste energy? And I was reading this to a friend, and the friend started laughing and said, why don't we use the word neighbors instead of competitors? And I read it to my niece, who's not particularly politicized, and she threw her hands up in the air and said, don't these people understand anything about community? And the point is that this notion that this, for me, in many ways, gets to the heart of what's wrong with this culture, is the belief that that redwood trees understand the reason they might warn some, quote, competitor is because they understand that a forest consists of more than one species, and that the point of life is not to play Risk and to eliminate everybody else and end up the conqueror of the world. But the point of life is actually to have long-term relationships within your land base. And all of this is a way around back to our, you know, the general insanity of this culture and what we were talking about just a moment ago, where you were saying that a lot of academics are underselling things, and there's worse problems too, and that happens with activists. And I just want to say one of the things that has always struck me as completely insane is that so many of the solutions, and I do not include you in this insanity at all. That's one of the things I love about your work, is you're one of the few people who is not stark raving mad. And, which compared to this culture, I guess, is damning with faint praise, but, you know. Anyway, sorry, I mean, I do think your work is fabulous. I'm not saying that it's not. I'm just saying that this whole thing is so crazy that the fact that we're even talking about, well, the fact that we could go extinct is completely nuts when people are not running around screaming about this 24 hours a day. Long way around of all the so-called solutions that we see to global warming, they all take industrial capitalism as a given and the natural world as being forced to conform to industrial capitalism, as opposed to recognizing that the real world is primary. And that has to be taken first. And so I'm just wondering, you know, given all that, if you can talk about how science gets co-opted back into serving capitalism as opposed to the real world, how activism gets co-opted back into it, how, like, almost everything we attempt to do, there's this huge blind spot where people presume that capitalism is actually more important than the real world.
Yes, it's astonishing. And when I was reading your work, very, very actively 10 or 15 years ago, and then reading the works of others that your work led me to, it occurred to me how insane I had been, that I was a scientist, just like all the other scientists I knew, pointing out, using well-accepted methods, that almost everything we do is killing the planet. But that, like everybody else, I was not asking for anybody to make any changes, not of any significance anyway. And my friend Tim Bennett explains this best with a simple line: we're born into captivity. And most people don't even see the cage. Most people don't even see the bars surrounding them. We're born into a set of living arrangements. None of us had a choice about that. We just showed up. And the set of living arrangement exists, and we spend the first many years of our lives thinking this is normal, because, of course, this is all we've ever known, and so it must be normal. And so we just keep on as if this is what matters, because this is what we know. I was raised in a really small logging community, a timber extraction town in northern Idaho, and...
Oh, where? I lived in North Idaho for a while.
I lived in Weipe, which probably you haven't heard of. It's the first place that the Nez Perce Indians met Lewis and Clark in the Corps of Discovery. It was on the Weipe Prairie, and the little town of white people that grew up around there came to be called Weipe, undoubtedly a co-opted indigenous word. And so it's this timber extraction community, and nobody there, of course, questioned the notion of timber extraction, because that was the source of their livelihood. Everybody's job depended upon the ability to cut down big trees and take them to market. And so when all you know is what surrounds you, it's like a fish doesn't know there's water. We didn't know that there was another way to live, and most people in this culture don't. Has that there's another way to live, because it's so well hidden. And in fact, even when somebody describes another way to live, they talk about it in disparaging, derogatory terms, such as the Stone Age, as if the Stone Age was the most horrible set of circumstances ever. And oh my goodness, at least we're above that. We've got this going on. We have Wi-Fi and smartphones, so we're so much better off than we would have been otherwise. It's insane. And the insanity doesn't end, and we're all born into this insanity, so we don't even see it. We're like the fish in the water that can't see the water, even though it's all around us. That's the only explanation I can come up with to describe how we got to be so absolutely insane, is that it was this gradual step, once the first civilization began a few thousand years ago, to now we're in this thing, you know, the most omnicidal, horrific civilization ever. And unlike the previous civilizations, this one since 1939 or so has been a one-way street. It's not only a cul-de-sac, it's a one-way street. Whereas the Mimbres, where I live, experienced civilization, and within 20 years, civilization collapsed. So the Mimbres didn't go back to civilization. Immediately thereafter, they began forsaking corn, which had allowed them to go into human population overshoot and then collapse catastrophically. The survivors walked away from civilization and never again went back. Well, we can't do that now since the nuclear age. We can't just turn off the switch of industrial civilization and save our own species, because that triggers the catastrophic meltdown of 400 and some nuclear power plants. And Fukushima alone represents a grave threat to all human beings in the Northern Hemisphere. So we can only imagine what that would be like for to do that at the level of hundreds of nuclear power plants.
So that actually raises something that a question I think about a lot, which is, so well, there's two ways I want to put this. One is, so we know that these feedback loops on global warming are in place, but oftentimes the models presume a continuation of the burning of fossil fuels. And so I got two sort of questions here, which may be related. One of them is, what do you think would happen in terms of these feedback loops if humans disappeared tomorrow, such that no more fossil fuel was burned? And the terrible news there is that many of these nuclear power plants would go ballistic, more or less literally. And the good news is that grasslands and forests have just an absolutely unfathomable capacity to sequester carbon, and life really wants to live and would, I mean, Chernobyl in many ways gives me some solace in terms of the wolves having returned. So there, that's part of the question. And another question, which may or may not be related, is what is your realistic, whatever that word means, what is your realistic best case scenario for the future? I want to say one more thing first, which ties into all this, which is that I have a friend who always says, John Osborne, a wonderful dear friend of mine, who always says the reason that he does his environmental work is because we can't predict the future. And as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open, so that if the Pacific tree frogs are around in 10 years, they may be around in 100. And if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. So I'm not asking for you to give something definitive, but just, you know, where do you – I guess I'm rambling too much. So go ahead. Just answer those questions however you'd like.
No, that's right. We can't predict the future with anything resembling great precision. And as a consequence, I continue to work to terminate industrial civilization, even though it almost certainly leads to the death of all humans on the planet in the not-too-distant future. Because, well, there's a lot to unpack there. We're going to die anyway. It's not a given that Homo sapiens is going to persist any longer than any other species, and we've been around only about 1/7 as long as the typical species of mammal right now. But that doesn't suggest that we're promised another 7 times as long. So I continue to promote the notion that industrial civilization is horrific and is killing everything it can get its so-called hands on, and so we should stop this madness. because we know it's madness. And Chernobyl gives me hope, not just because of the wolves, many of which have mutations that will be horrific in future generations, but also because there was a new species discovered. I believe it was a slime mold, but I'm not certain of that, in the sarcophagus of Chernobyl. So apparently, try as we might to unleash ionizing radiation at enormous levels, we can't even kill everything by doing that. So what I'm working for is the 10 million years conservation biologist at Harvard, Edward O. Wilson, says it takes to recover from a great extinction event. In 10 million years, if we save some seeds, some species, then we will have a vibrant living planet again. If we don't save any of those seeds, though, if we continue to kill them, destroy the species at up to 200 species a day, then we're not going to have those seeds. We're reducing the ability of the planet to come back anytime in the future. So I'm working not on behalf of Homo calidus, the clever apes, which is what really we should have been called instead of the wise apes, Homo sapiens. I'm not working on behalf of our species, but instead on behalf of as many other species as potentially could make it through an industrial civilization bottleneck. We don't know how many species that's going to be, just like we don't know as individuals how long our own lives are going to last. But we can take steps that will ensure the maximum possible future for other species, just like we can take steps that ensure the maximum possible future, including quality of life, for us as individuals. Just because I think we're headed for human extinction in the near term doesn't mean I don't floss my teeth. So I think we should be working for that future that may not include us.
Well, we're running out of time, but I also just want to say, I mean, well, one thing is I would love to have you back again sometime soon if you'd like. And the other is about the floss and the teeth, that, you know, part of the reason that I do all the work I do is because I love the natural world and I love the frogs and the sow bugs and everybody else. And another part of the reason is because I'm fundamentally conservative, and I just think it's a really bad idea to make huge changes without considering the consequences, such as, you know, making it so there aren't any fish in the ocean. I just think it's like the flossing the teeth thing. The reason I floss my teeth is not because I enjoy flossing my teeth, but because I'm fundamentally conservative. And I would rather have the option of keeping my teeth in my mouth until I die.
Right. I mean, it's going to be a lot less expensive to keep your own teeth than it is to purchase another set.
Oh, gosh. That's something I would love to talk with you about in the future, too, is the notion that if the natural world does something, then it doesn't actually count as true functionality. But if we make it ourselves, then it's a really special thing. So if we make crap teeth, and that shows how smart we are, as opposed to the real world made real teeth, but the real world, it doesn't actually have an intelligence. But that's actually going a whole big direction. Anyway, so we've got about a minute left. I think it's pretty clear what would you like to leave listeners with, and what would you like for listeners to do?
I would like for listeners to act as if we're in hospice, to treat each other with kindness and compassion and dignity, to even if we're on our way out, to create those moments that we will remember in our final minutes or our final hours, and they will be moments of joy. I want to invoke the Hippocratic Oath here. First, do no harm. Let's try to make for a better moment, hence for a better future, in the time we have left. And I'm not talking about a better world by accumulating more gold for us as individuals, but rather for the living planet. That's primary, as you pointed out so many times in your own work. The living planet is primary. Let's work to make it as healthy as we possibly can.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to the next time, Derek.
Yeah, me too. So I'd like to thank the listeners for listening. My guest today has been Guy McPherson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Ha ha ha!